You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
George Saunders is probably the only former convenience store clerk ever to win a MacArthur Genius Award. He's gained a wide range of admirers for his fiction over the years, including other leading writers like Thomas Pynchon and Jonathan Franzen. And now Riverhead has published Mr. Saunders' first collection of essays called The Brain Dead Megaphone. I'm very pleased to welcome George Saunders back to the show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Have you been writing nonfiction all along with the fiction?
No, I haven't. I think the first thing I wrote from this book was the piece about Huck Finn was about 99. But then somehow I found myself writing more of it after 9/11 and then after the Iraq invasion, or suddenly it felt more urgent somehow.
Were people coming to you with suggestions? Oh, GQ, hey, George, we'd love you to write a piece.
Not yet, not at that point. But sometimes someone would say, would you write a little something about Vonnegut? And I think for a while I thought that was sort of not something I should be doing. But then after 9/11, I felt like, well, I might not know much, but I, you know, probably know as much as the people making the decisions or so, you know.
The reason they asked you to write about Vonnegut is because you've expressed great admiration for mm-hmm. him. And some other writers people might associate you with, obviously inspired by Mark Twain.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you want to think about why you like those writers? Are you willing to put that down on paper?
I am willing to try. And what I find in the end, of course, is that you don't quite do it justice, because like so many things in writing, there's the kind of reductive angle on it. You can say how to write a good story, and you can say it. But of course, in reality, it's like any other important thing. It's just sort of intuitive. But I do. I like to work through those writers and just try to, one, you know, just to say thanks and pay tribute, and two, to sort of subject my aesthetic to the rigor that revision causes you to bring forth. So in other words, in writing about Vonnegut, I'm going to find out what I really love about him and what I want to emulate and so on.
Well, you say that he, reading Slaughterhouse-Five, got you thinking about kindness in writing.
Yeah, I mean, I know as a young writer, I think I had the idea that savagery was sophisticated, you know. And as I get older and you start to see that actually kindness is the hardest thing to do, well, in writing and probably also in life. And it takes a certain confidence to say, as he does over and over, you know, damn it, you've got to be kind.
Although there's a certain amount of savagery in
some
of these
right,
essays.
That's right, yeah.
Saying that, there's also, I'm sure, the side of you're a fiction writer, and there are things that you just read in the newspaper, see on television, and you know you can't get them into a work of fiction, but right. You want to tell the world. You want to tell somebody other than the person you're sitting next to at
right,
that time.
Right. Well, what I found, I didn't know this before I wrote this book, but I really don't like to criticize people. I like to criticize tendencies. You know, I feel viscerally, I feel very outraged by, you know, hubris and greed and arrogance. But when it's probably a character flaw, but when I try to write about an actual person with those things, I flinch. I just would rather look past that and try to find something good. So in fiction, I can kind of take the gloves off. And in the nonfiction, it's a different tendency. It's saying, you know, talking to a Minuteman and getting a couple easy quotes where you could nail the guy, but then trying to persist and say, now, do you really mean that? And kind of, that is more interesting to me in nonfiction somehow.
Mm-hmm. You know? It's hard for anybody to do it because you're looking, as long as you're sitting next to the person and watching that person get nervous, you're aware of the humanity of even the most awful person.
That's right. And I think as, you know, and this is a generality, but as the culture gets more electronic, it's funny, I'll get every so often a really caustic email from, I have Syracuse account at the university, so I'm really obnoxious, saying things that you wouldn't say in person. And I always make a point of writing back and saying, well, and the second email from the person is always better, kinder, and sort of more, you know, humane.
Well, it's good that it works that way. Sometimes sometimes it escalates. I've had that experience.
Sure.
And my answer now is I just don't respond to the really crazy ones. In the title essay, The Brain Dead Megaphone, you call our venture into Iraq a literary failure. Mm. Is this another thing we're going to blame George Bush for?
No,
a literary failure?
I think we should, but if we stop there, we're probably making a mistake. You know, I think my take on the war is that a culture has this machine that tells it stories, and that's of course literature, but also the media. And I think in our time, especially the big 24/7 TV stations seem to be doing a lot of work in that area. Okay, fair enough. when we get in a national crisis, that machine is supposed to kick in and make us smart. My take on the whole thing was you get Fox leading the charge, a foreshortened, anxiety-ridden debate that already had made up its mind. So you didn't hear a whole lot of real viable pacifist voices. You just heard generals describing which route would be the most efficient. So what this means is when an important decision comes to us, we have to be able to imagine in three dimensions, which is what literature helps us do, and I think what we fail to do there.
But why do you think that is? You say that the best and the brightest create work in the media. Why do they cop out? Is it simply that their bosses tell them to do what they want them to do and that's it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I had a friend, a guy I knew who was in the movie business, and he had directed a series of kind of goofy movies, you know, sort of exploitation type movies. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, everybody in town here who's not doing good work, is they think they're doing crappy work in order to make a space for themselves to do Citizen Kane. And he said, of course, there's a flaw in that, but I think that's actually true. There's also something, and I'm not smart enough or in the media world enough to know, but it does seem to me that in my lifetime, the profit motive has loomed large. You know, in 1965, I expect that if somebody had, you know, found some dirt Mother Teresa with no panties, we wouldn't have heard about it. But now we do. And I think there's this kind of very subtle method by which people of conscience give up their right to stop things. And they say, well, it benefits the shareholders. And we've taken that as a kind of a mantra. And I think it's sort of circulated down some way.
The essay also in some ways seems to be a defense of writing literary fiction in a time when so many people say that fiction can't compete with reality anymore.
Right. Well, that's my job, so I want to make sure. No, I think, you know, if you...
And you're a writer of fiction at a time when the polls indicate more and more people say that they don't read fiction, they only want to read nonfiction because that's reality.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I've thought about a lot is that it's not just how many people interact with your work, it's what happens to them, you know, when they interact with... I remember reading The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison's novel, and something so powerful happened where it sort of reawakened all these old Catholic mystic experiences I'd had as a kid. And some switch got thrown on in my mind that has to do with how you imagine the other. And it got thrown on, and it hasn't gone off. And this has been, you know, 12 or 13 years. So that is worth how many thousand episodes of ALF, you know. So I don't think I think we should probably, those of us who read, probably should take heart in the fact that it's not just about numbers. It's not about how many, but how deeply.
My guest is George Saunders, the author of In Persuasion Nation, The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, Pastoralia, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, a children's book, The Very Persistent Gappers of Fripp, named one of the best American writers under 40 by The New Yorker and one of Entertainment Weekly's most creative people. If E.T. says, E.W. says you're good, then you must be good. His latest book is his first collection of nonfiction called The Brain Dead Megaphone. It's published by Riverhead. How did you wind up traveling to Dubai? You go to Dubai and Nepal.
Yeah. I got approached by Jim Nelson and Andy Ward at GQ, and I think they had read the fiction, and especially the first book, Civil War Land, which is kind of about dystopian artificial environments where the haves are manipulating the have-nots. And that sounded like Dubai. So they asked if I wanted to do it. And at first I didn't want to, but then my daughter said, you know, Dad, you should do it because you've never done anything cool. And I'm like, yes, I have. And I named about three things that were all in 1972 or something. So kind of spurred by her, I went. And it was just, the assignment was just write 10,000 sort of literary / funny words. And so it was such, they really trusted me to go out there and try to find something.
But they also expected you to come back with something that was similar to what you'd already written. Did you find what you expected?
No. And I think the great thing was they didn't mind when I got off the path. But when I went with that story, and it was only 7 days, so I'm sure I blew it in some major way. But what I saw was the complications of that basic scenario. That basic scenario is true. But one, the artificial environments are gorgeous. They're like a dreamlike atmosphere that they've made with these artificial Arab cities. And also that the people who were being exploited at different levels and with different levels of feelings about that. Some people were like, yeah, I understand that this is not America and I don't have full rights, but compared to Saudi Arabia, it's pretty darn good. I'm building my mother a house, you know. So it was complicated.
And you have a great anecdote about how veiled Saudi Arabian teenagers get dates.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy from Aramco, and he said what they do is that you go to a mall, and the boys and the girls are walking. Of course, the girls are veiled. If a girl sees a boy she likes, she drops her cell phone number in front of him. First she takes a picture of herself with her camera on the cell phone. She texts it to him some complicated way. Anyway, if he likes it, he calls the number.
So she takes a picture of herself unveiled.
Right. She lifts the veil, takes a picture. Maybe it's the other way. The boy sends, you know, who knows? I couldn't do it opposite. I'd be single if I was in Saudi Arabia. But it's a complicated technological exchange that takes place as they walk by each other in the mall.
You stayed at a 7-star hotel in Dubai. I didn't know there were 7-star.
There aren't, actually. There's only 5. So that was what made it so special. It's called the Burj Al Arab, and it's the one that looks like a big sail. And I think my off-season rate was $3,000 a night for a 2-story suite with a Liberace stairwell. But, of course, this is a big moment for me in the first piece of nonfiction I'd ever written. And I'm kind of from working back, so I always feel out of place in any hotel, much less this one. And it turns out that for complicated reasons, they hadn't been prepaid. And my wife and I had run our credit cards up to the max. So I'm in this thing, and they take you up. This lovely Moldavian woman takes you up. And now if we could please address the nasty issue of payment. And I have to sort of say to her, I don't actually have it, you know, but could I pay you half today, half tomorrow? So for the next 24 hours, I'm just scrambling to get the ATM to spit out the $3,000. So, of course, it's the kind of thing where you don't want to put that in your story until you realize it's actually the emotional heart of the story, is that it's great to be a have, kind of sucks to be a have not, and there I was sort of straddling that border.
You asked various people why Al-Qaeda hadn't bombed Dubai, because it is very materialistic
yes.
place. And what did they tell you?
Basically that it was the Switzerland of the Middle East, that a lot of organizations, not only Al-Qaeda but other mafia type, or they do their banking there. And so there's sort of a tacit agreement that we can just coexist. So it's funny. It's an interesting look into that sort of psyche, because it actually isn't about the excess and the materialism. It's about something else.
But you met some very different kinds of people when you went to Peshawar. That's in Pakistan.
Right.
That's on the border with Afghanistan. You met Mujahideen?
I did. This was back when the Russians were involved there. And I had this kind of
corny... That was a long time ago.
It was in the 80s, 86 or something. But I had this... before that even, 82, I think. But I had this corny idea that I would sneak into Afghanistan and do a Hemingway. And luckily, I scared myself out of it. But there were...
Didn't William Vollman do that?
He did that. He did that about the same time. And
did you know each other?
No, not at all. And he wrote beautifully about it, so I was glad I didn't do that and do it less well than he did.
Can you mentioned earlier the militiamen. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that there were Chicano militiamen. Are there? I mean, are there Mexican-Americans who are also part of the militia?
Yes, there are actually. Well, and it's the Minutemen. It's this group that actually...
I meant Minutemen.
Yeah. They kind of claim to be bigger than they are, I think. And they have a couple of... They had one African-American guy I met and a couple of Mexican women. I mean, literally two that they kind of bring around with them. But the people are very sincere. Actually, on the border, there's a lot of tension between Mexican-Americans who've sort of gone the legal route and those who haven't. So.
And what happened when you told them that you were a bona fide Eastern liberal?
Well, I had the feeling I would go in sort of sneaky. And when I got there, that started to feel less interesting. So they were... it was fun. We had a party. They were kind of making fun of me, and I was making fun of them. And we stayed up all night, guarding our nation here out on the border.
But how much of that is theater? They carry guns. They can't legally shoot at anybody. They can't even detain border crossers.
Right. I thought of it as kind of a reenactors club. They're all sort of Vietnamed out. And in Texas, the guns are legal, but they've got some serious stuff that I think is maybe not so legal. And they've got 6 and 7 weapons each. So I felt it was kind of a chance to sort of play out the fantasy. And they know, the people I met anyway, knew their limits, they knew the rules. The only scary thing was they were not professional soldiers, and they were, at one point, a gun was against a tree and somebody knocked it over, you know, and it was a little bit loose.
How did you come to write about Buddha Boy?
Somebody at GQ had found this story about this little boy near the Indian border who supposedly had been meditating 7 months without food or water. And
the opposite of Dubai.
Totally the opposite of Dubai.
This isn't even a 1-star hotel.
There wasn't even a hotel. So we got to go out and with my translator, and we actually got to spend the night there with him in this little enclosure where he meditates.
To what end, if any at all, was the Buddha boy meditating?
He said he told his brother he had a vision, and the vision said two things. If you don't do this, you'll die, and you need to meditate for world peace. So I think he's sort of following the Buddhist path of trying to attain enlightenment.
And you attempted to verify that he didn't cheat at night. Mm-hmm. Were you able to?
Scientifically, no, because it's very hard to prove a negative. But I sat out all night with him. I fell asleep for about maybe an hour tops. But the funny thing was, it was so quiet, and there was nobody out there but his brother and a friend. No, they locked the barbed wire, his double barbed wire. They locked it at 9, and nobody, you can hear, if you pass wind, it sounds like a nuclear explosion out there. So I'm sitting there all night, and there wasn't a sound, And you wake up in the morning, sun comes up, and the kid is still sitting there in the exact posture he'd been in for, by our observation, 2 days, not moving a muscle. So even if there was some way he was eating, which I doubt, just the fact that he could sit there for so long was astonishing to see.
And what effect did he have on the locals?
At first, they hated him, and they, because these are people who knew him, and they would come at night and poke him with sticks and make fun of him and tempt him with food. And the most moving thing I saw was that all of these people, young and old, had been won over. They were kind of reverent, like, even his mom, we don't know. We don't know what's going on, but obviously something very special is happening here.
Do we know what's happened to him?
He got up at some point. It was too noisy. That was always a problem because a lot of tourists or a lot of pilgrims come there. And at one point, he moved deeper into the jungle. And the last I heard, he'd moved deeper still and had asked for a pit to be dug. And he's going to go into the pit for 6 years. So there's something very special going on.
But you were also there at a time of political turmoil, weren't you? Nepal, I don't know whether you met any of the Maoist rebels.
We didn't meet them, but there was a shooting just a couple miles up from where he was the day that we were there. So you really felt the anguish of the Nepali people in trying to figure out what to do with this. And I had the feeling that he sort of, in some complicated way, his appearing was related in their minds to this political uproar.
But what about that whole ideal of abandoning desire? Hmm. It's the total antithesis to Western thinking.
Right. I think it's confusing, too, because even in the Buddhist tradition, that's actually not what it says. It's not about abandoning desire. And the Buddha himself he abandoned those sort of ascetic practices. So it's not quite clear why he's decided to not eat or drink. There actually isn't, as far as I was able to tell, much Buddhist precedent for it. But it did make me think, how much our day-to-day life is dominated by desire, food, water, sex, praise, rest, ease. And in his case, I sat there for a night, and of course I couldn't sit still for even 20 minutes. And by the end of it, you're sitting on the dirt, and your body's aching, and you're yearning for warmth. It was the coldest night in Nepali history, or 100 years or something, freezing, almost hypothermic. And then to see the kid sitting there, he had less than a shawl on. It was literally just like a cloth across his chest, not moving. It was really stunning to see that people have different physical limits of endurance and so on. And he was clearly bringing something else to that equation.
Well, you must have understood some of that kind of sacrifice because you'd also worked as an oil engineer, a convenience store clerk, a knuckle puller at a West Texas slaughterhouse. Were you all the time desiring to be a writer?
For most of it, I was. There was a time, I think since about 18, I knew I wanted to do it, but couldn't quite figure out how that would be done. So did a lot of those kind of inefficient jobs just to try to make a living. But it was, it's interesting because in those jobs too, especially like the slaughterhouse, you see that one's grace and generosity and courage and all these wonderful traits is absolutely tied to your physical well-being. So if you come back from 12, 13 hours at the slaughterhouse, you actually are a somewhat lesser person than you were when you went. And so to see this kid who somehow had gotten outside of that whole cycle of physicality was really unbelievable.
We don't have time to get into some of the other things like the George Saunders MySpace army, but can we just address your manifesto for people reluctant to kill for an abstraction for a moment?
Yes.
Now, obviously, you've taken a playful and funny tone here, but I suspect this was a very serious thing your mind.
It was. I was actually here in the city, and I remember standing somewhere under an awning during a thunderstorm and just watching the people go by. And in the news, there was some big terrorist thing on. And I thought how numerically the people who don't want any trouble are a vast majority. The people who basically they're thinking about their kids, trying to get through the next day, don't have any reason whatsoever to resort to violence at all. And how actually if those people could somehow form a terrorist group and take over the world, it would be kind of a simpler deal.
Now, you've written short stories. Mm. No novels, have you?
No, not yet.
What's the difference between writing a short story and writing an essay? They often are of the same length, aren't they?
Yeah, lengthwise. For me, the difference is that in a story, I would say a story is a somewhat higher form because you really aren't constrained, in my case, by facts, trying to hurt people's feelings, you can sort of riff on human tendencies more energetically. And an essay, the fun thing about these pieces was you'd go on the road, you'd come back with, in my case, 100 pages of single space typing. The story is there. You don't get to make it up, but you get to extract and then refine.
And you also get to use all of the things you learn from writing fiction
really
in writing the nonfiction, and that's why some people write more interesting nonfiction than others. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. George Saunders' latest book is his first collection of nonfiction called The Brain Dead Megaphone. It is published by Riverhead. And thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
And for me too. Thank you.